Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to our final seminar. Remember, if you'd like to hang around and hang out a bit at the end of the seminar, we can have a discussion, question and answer, and an exchange of what hopefully will be some added interest and hopefully value to you for things that we may not have discussed in the link that you'd like, or there may be some questions that have been raised that I just haven't gotten to in a satisfying way for you. So as we begin, we're going to be talking in this seminar about specifically neuromarketing your professional services and products, and look at some aspects of neuromarketing that really align the marketing of practice with specifically how the mind and brain work. And it's always nice to go in the flow of, you know, in Texas, the saying is, it's easier to ride a horse in the direction it's going. So this is to take the mind, brain, and sometimes performance sciences into mind with your coaching services products. But first, thoughts, discussions, things you'd like to talk about or questions to ask before we begin the final seminar. Is our discussion what you expected, and have there been things that you found of value, perhaps of specific value to your coaching practice to this point? And then you know I'm going to follow up. What else would you like to discuss to be sure that it's really a specific value? So anything that you've found so far, either of surprise or benefit to you. Anyone, anything? Are there things that you want to be sure we still discuss? Maybe I need to work on my questions. Before we start, anything anyone would like to, I see there are a good number of people here, and you guys are lurking. Anything you'd like to discuss or add or ask before we start the seminar? I can start, and then we'll have more time at the end, but anything now you want to add, ask, or just highlight? Okay. I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and we'll begin. Okay, in talking about neuromarketing of your professional services and products, here's the neuromarketing quiz I'd like to begin with. Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to look at the major factor that determined whether someone engaged or declined services from the professionals. Which do you think was most important? Years of experience, reputation, the amount of the fee, degrees and certifications, stating recommendations and fee clearly and confidently, or state of the economy? Now, here additionally, we'll come back to that. Jot down your response. It is one of those five. For those of you who have heard me maybe give this quiz before, it'd be a trick question and the answer was not in the multiple choice. The answer is in there, one of those five. So here are four questions to consider. Jot down immediately a yes or a no for each question. And these are in your outline, an immediate yes or no. Do you earn your living by offering others goods or services? Do you work for yourself or run your own operation, even if part-time? Does your work require elastic skills, the ability to do a variety of different functions throughout the day, at least at this point in your practice? And four, do you work in education, training, human resources, or healthcare? And of course, coaching would be in that group of human resources. Now, if you answer yes to any one of these four questions, you are in sales and service. If you're a doctor, attorney, accountant, consultant, coach, business professional, you're in sales and service. To deliver a fantastic experience to your prospects is the best sales strategy there is. So here's an operating definition of neuromarketing for us. Neuromarketing integrates biological and social sciences to understand unconscious choices and the underlying brain activity that determines consumer behavior. Think about how new this application of mind and brain science is, that we now can look at and study the brain directly under various situations, a number of different kinds of decisions, to look at the process that's going on and match that process with the outcome, often, for example, the choice. When we engage potential prospects with a product or service in mind, we invite them to part with their resources, including time, attention, and effort, and usually money. If they do, we'll bring value and they will benefit from the engagement. Teachers sell their students that the science lesson they're teaching is interesting and beneficial. In healthcare, the physical therapist helps someone recover from injury to handle resources, time, attention, and effort, because patients can get healthier if they use these resources wisely. To move people effectively and powerfully requires seeing them as a participant, as a collaborator. Now, here's what happens when you don't do that. And this is a review. We've touched on this. When people consult a physician, fewer than 50% who get a prescription from this expert consultant actually fill it. Of those who do fill it, fewer than 50% take it as this expert directed. So when someone is motivated by fear and pain, inconvenienced by time, sometimes by travel, and have to pay to consult an expert, less than 25 actually follow that expert advice. What's missing? It's just information. It doesn't become their story. Now, consider this question for yourself, and I'd suggest write down a specific number as soon as you hear the question. What percent of your real work involves convincing or persuading people to give up something they value for something you have, something that will bring them great value? Almost 10,000 professionals around the world were surveyed to address this question. Nearly everyone considered this aspect a crucial component of their success. Yet while most people believe direct persuasion is crucial for professional success, the time allocated to engaging and directly persuading people was in the low single digits. What we find valuable and what we actually do may differ significantly. When we work for ourselves, as entrepreneurs, we become salespeople as well. What people in sales do is to move people. You can tell the ones who don't do this. Their kids get really skinny. The persuasion industry, now led by neuromarketing, focuses on most everything we buy. What we purchase for emotional reasons and then justify by logic is shaped in ways so subtle that we may have failed to recognize them. Here's a really simple example of a failure in influence. A cigar manufacturer spent considerable money on an ad that depicted a beautiful smiling woman handing out cigars to her husband and his friends. This was attractively done in an elegant English library setting, widely displayed. The result, a dramatic fall in cigar sales. What happened? When men smoke cigars, they unconsciously feel dominant and important. By showing a woman encouraging a man to smoke and being subservient to her offering, the advertisement psychologically countered the male customer's intent. So, here are some misconceptions about selling. Several years ago, my good buddy Art Wilson was the number one salesperson in IBM's group of over 10,000 healthcare sales professionals before he moved to a senior executive position. He then took an early retirement to start his own hugely successful consulting company, working with the sales forces of multinational corporations, and co-founded with me our What's Next Exec retreats. You'd never guess he was in sales. He's a big, gentle, laid-back, lovable guy, kind of like me. In researching this material, I asked him if there are any common misconceptions about selling. He immediately said the two biggest ones. One, selling is a natural gift. For more than 90% of people, including the most successful salesperson, this is not true. Someone may do the right thing for the right reason, but it has to be combined with the right style and emotion. It's an art and a science with its own body of knowledge. Art really did not like sales. He did it anyhow, and he did what he needed to do, but he never loved sales. He loved people. And two, the other misconception, the best salespeople have no call reluctance. Over 90% of the best salespeople regularly have call reluctance. But they do it anyhow by getting in an optimum state of mind and sticking to their plan. Pick people you want to reach out to and do it. You don't have to be motivated, but you do have to have a plan and stick to it. And shrink the change. Contact a designated number of people per day. From a number of conversations and interviews with outstanding sales professionals, these two questions form the heart of the sales exchange. One, if the person you are selling to agrees to buy, will his or her life improve? And secondly, when your interaction is over, will the world be a better place than when you began? If your answer to either of these is not yes, you need to recalibrate. It's said that marketers most often make these mistakes, assuming people are rational, assuming people are eager for change, assuming that once someone knows things the way you know them, they're going to choose what you choose or what you offer. And here's an addendum to that. It's what you think you already know that may most prevent you from learning. So let's look at the 1%. What is that, you ask? Good. Professor Harold Cope teaches law and emphasizes that in an attempt to understand the law or in understanding just about anything, the key is to focus on what he calls the 1%, to not get lost in the details, but to think about the essence of what is really important, the 1% that gives life to the other 99%. Understanding that 1% and especially being able to explain it to others is the hallmark of a strong position. Think about what that 1% is, for example, for your mentor coaching work with a client. The 1% is the essence of simplicity and clarity, whether you're selling a service or a product or trying to convince anybody of anything. What's the 1%? When you can answer that clearly, briefly, succinctly, convey it to others, you and they are most likely to be moved. Einstein said this very simply. If you can't state your position simply, you don't understand it well enough. And Seth Godin doubled down Einstein and said, if you can't state your position in 8 words or less, you don't have a position. The purpose of a 1%, or to think of the purpose of how you convey what you do, is not necessarily to move someone else to adopt your idea. The purpose is to offer something so compelling that it begins a conversation. And as many of you recall, we discussed this in the hub statement. The ideal response to a hub statement of 10 to 12 words or less is, oh, tell me more. The purpose is to offer something so compelling that it begins a conversation. The measure of success after your statement is when the other person says, tell me more. The other person begins being a participant to eventually arrive at an effort and an outcome together that appeals to both of you and is of value to both of you. So let's think of that in a conceptual way. What's your value proposition? And there are basically three common types of value proposition. So this is a way simply, to put it in other words, to articulate your 1%. One is the one-word pitch. What's the one characteristic that you most want associated with your name, your business, and your brand? A one-word equity. When anyone thinks of you, they associate that word. When anyone says the word, they think of you. Initially, it was to make up a name when I named my website, my coaching firm, Mentor Path. More recently, moving into the application of mind, brain, and performance sciences into peak performance, it was to make up another name, NeuroMentor. It amalgamated psychology, neuroscience, and mentor coaching. Other examples, each to date are a little more famous than NeuroMentor. What technology company do you think of when you hear the word search? What credit card company comes to mind when you hear the word priceless? Obviously, Google and MasterCard. Those are one-word equity, one-word pitches. In his 2012 re-election campaign, President Obama built his entire strategy around one word, forward. Second is the question pitch. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was running for president in a very grim economy. Reagan simply asked a question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? The question was designed not to make people come up with their, was designed rather to make people come up with their own reasons for agreeing or not, which is what a question does. It engages somebody as opposed to giving information. They're going to decide whether they agree with you or not. When people come up with their own answers for agreeing or believing something, they endorse the belief more strongly and become more likely to act on it because it becomes their story, not giving a prescription and telling somebody to do what you, the expert, says. And third, the Twitter pitch. Brief, simple, specific. A micro message, back in the old days of Twitter, of 140 or fewer characters. The mark of an effective tweet, like an effective pitch, is that it engages recipients and encourages them to take the conversation further. Further may be, in this context, sharing a tweet, responding, clicking a link, or all the way to signing on for a teleconference, a seminar, a workshop, a retreat. What tweets do you think have had the highest rating? Readers assign the highest rating to tweets that ask questions of followers. This confirms the power of questions to engage and to persuade. Now, asking the right questions has more power than giving people the right answers. Because instead of giving information that they either agree or disagree with, if they agree, they, with their confirmation bias, will seek reasons to affirm that. If they disagree, they will seek reasons to either give inattention or to refute it. And the brighter someone is, as we've touched on before, and the more flexible they are intellectually, the more entrenched in their original position they would be based on information and data. And this is called the boomerang effect. And the second aspect of this, appreciative inquiry, can get much better results than seeking out and solving problems. That's simply to look at the positive, at possibility, at the challenge, rather than booting up a problem mindset or going into understanding why. So let's look at two aspects of this, your purpose and your plan. Your purpose. Three key questions will help you prepare your value proposition, whichever of these three varieties that we just talked about you choose, or some amalgamation. You will clarify your purpose by making sure that you can answer these three questions. What do you want them to know? What do you want them to feel? And then, what do you want them to do? So, let's look at this in more detail. That's the purpose. This is the plan. Before you connect with a prospect, write down the following four things as a plan. What would we talk about that would be the highest value objective of a client for a brief conversation? What are two to three good questions to ask this prospect? If this call or discussion or email is successful, what's the next best action for that person and for me to take? And four, if we have time, what are some additional possible topics for the discussion? Now, for most people, the opposite of talking isn't listening. It's waiting. When others speak, we usually divide our attention between what they're saying now and what we're about to say next. The result is a mediocre halfway position on both. Some professionals don't even bother to wait. A typical study found that physicians interrupt the majority of patients in the first 18 seconds that they begin to speak during an appointment. This often prevents patients from describing what brought them to the office in the first place. Now, here's an example of listening differently. Suppose you're raising money for a charity and ask someone to contribute $200. If she says, "Sorry, I can't give $200, consider that as an offer. Perhaps you can donate a smaller amount. Or she might say, "I'm sorry, I can't do it right now." Consider that as an offer as well. Always looking at possibility. Focus on the right now and ask, when might be a better time? Or even consider the entire sentence as an offer, perhaps to contribute to your charity in some other way, such as being a volunteer. This way to hear responses as offers, as possibility, to open rather than to close, can come in all shapes and sizes. It simply is a reframe of the way you listen and how you respond. When both parties view an encounter as an opportunity to learn, the desire to sell or win fades in the background. It's a different mindset of collaboration and engagement. Consider this. You give information. Somebody listens, decides to agree or not. You ask a question, they respond. You immediately have a participant, and then you can go someplace new together. When we move from selling to serving, we engage the recipient as a collaborator and can become empathically attuned to their needs and can perhaps align how we can benefit that person. This non-salesy selling is the ability to influence, persuade, and change behavior while crafting a link between what someone else wants and needs and what you can provide them. We elicit from people what their specific goals are in order to frame what we can do to help them achieve those goals. Now, sales mastery. Remember, we're not talking about being salesy, but we are talking about offering a service or product. We're going to have to call it sales. So here's three phases of sales mastery. Engage, enroll, create conviction. Each component is based on knowing who your client is, the specific person you're about to engage in conversation. So first is engage, connect, and create interest. Now, important to your story is your hero. Who's the hero of your story? Heroes come in all varieties: teller, listener, customer, product, location, tribe. The hero needs to fit the goal. The hero is the character in the story who gives the audience a point of view. All the passion in the world won't do any good unless you have some place to put it. That's where the hero comes in. The hero serves as guide and surrogate, the character that the reader or listener identifies with. If the audience experiences the story through the hero, and the story leads the hero to embrace a call to action, then your audience will automatically hear your call to action as well. The hero enables your audience to feel the change your story promises. In every story, there's an element that can make the difference. That's the hero, the character, the product or brand the reader or viewer identifies with. Focus on the experience you deliver. I just finished an article in the Sunday Times that contrasted one of my all-time favorites, Ted Lasso, and the engaging, empathic character that he is with Ricky Gervais in The Office of a few decades ago, not that many decades ago, but how even Gervais said in today's climate, The Office would have never been picked up. He was an acerbic character, an unlikely guy. I mean, it didn't fit with what I saw, valued, or liked, and I never watched anything except some of the American version of it. So times change, but think about how you can engage someone with what their needs and their wants are at the current time. Now, we talked about in Seminar 1 how business and marketing stories like novels and film consist of three parts: the challenge, the struggle, and the resolution. The hero faces the challenge and fights through the struggle to the resolution. The hero may sometimes seem surprisingly hard to pinpoint, but unless you do, you have no story. The hero enables your audience to feel the change your story promises. In every story, there's an element that can make that difference. That's the hero, the character, the product, or brand the reader or viewer identifies with. And to reiterate again, finally, focus on the experience you deliver. That's how people buy. They buy emotionally and then boot it up to their prefrontal cortex and make it logical and conscious and sensible several seconds later and say, well, this is the reason I chose. And they believe that. And it's true, consciously. So when people donate to a charitable cause, it's not to save the lives of tens of thousands of children, but the best story is how you can save one child. You become the hero. For example, donation increases when moving from the abstract to the specific. A famine in Ethiopia was significantly enhanced in donation contribution when substituting a picture of Roika, a 7-year-old child who faces a threat of severe hunger or even starvation. You can't be a hero to a population. You can be a hero for a little guy like Roika. So how do you make your prospect the hero for your professional engagement? simply ask, what do you want to achieve? Where would you ideally like to be in 1 year? What for you would be an amazing achievement? Then your specialty is knowing how to catalyze growth and collaboratively get there together. You need to know the single most important thing you can offer them. Remember, it's not about you, it's about them. To find that single most important thing for them. So there are 6 keys to come to that. Know your prospects' challenges and needs. That's how you get in that circle. The stick figure, your client. You find out and resonate with their challenge, their need, something they haven't been able to do or be themselves. 2, know your own product. I mean, even I'm talking about product as mentor coaching even, and its advantages and benefits. Also, you're not going to compare yourself, but know your competition, but never depreciate a competitor. Know the potential objections to have answers ready. And I'll give you some examples of this in a minute. Expect the best, a state of positive anticipation. Create demand, ideally for the prospect to consider and convince himself or herself that this is the best thing. Anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. The hallmark of a true professional is the ability to manage a state of mind. So, for effective contact, set specific goals. Be creative, playful, and fun. Remember from my favorite grandmother, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have a plan for what you're going to say. And do it in abundance with qualified contacts. Keep going. You're most likely to stop yourself from making contact if you're not in a peak state or if you believe you're an interruption. To engage the prospect, connection and rapport are the foundation of all persuasion. Prospects will choose you because they trust you, like you, and especially because they have confidence in you. This confidence is the belief that you can help them get what they want or need. Importantly, they will choose you because they believe you have their best interest at heart. Remember, this has to be totally authentic. Now, here's the answer to the Wharton School of Business quiz. The single factor that most determined for several thousand professionals of different persuasions, whether someone are engaged or declined professional service, and it was the same reason to engage or the same reason to decline. The clarity and confidence of stating the recommendation and the fee. A confident state of mind is highly contagious. It's an energy field that's instantly transmissible, even by telephone, even by video conference. Caring people buy from caring people. They'll even help you close, as long as you have the prospect's best interests at heart. People want to feel cared for. We all want to be appreciated. People love people who change their state of mind. That's why entertainers are paid so much more than educators. Pro athletes, way more than service people. We want to be around people who change our state for the better and figure out how to get there ourselves. The law of reciprocation. Whatever you put out, it will come back many-fold. And that's the case for positive as well as negative. So, 3 psychological tactics for earning instant credibility to consider. Remember Lincoln's tactic at times. Argue against your own product or service. Indicate who the product or service is not for, if it's appropriate. It indicates you're not trying to sell to everyone, but a more specific benefit for specific people. People believe precise numbers. Which of these do you think is more believable? 60% of all American households recycle regularly, or 60.3% of American households recycle regularly. 78% of participants said the more specific number was more believable because it inferred accuracy. When you make a claim, provide proof to back it up. Here are some different forms of proof if no scientific studies exist: statistics, personal stories, testimonials, research, professional or media-given accolades. Now, the second step of sales mastery: enroll. Discover your prospects' needs and challenges. What are the needs, interests, and challenges of your specific prospect? Their real problems that you can help them solve. Highlight the problems. Resonate with the pain. This gets you inside the circle. This is what the prospect may even minimize or deny. Here are four qualifying questions to have in mind, not necessarily to ask out loud, but to have in mind. Needs. Ask yourself, what does the prospect really need? Wants. What does the prospect really want? Challenges. What are the primary needs or challenges this person have, whether or not they're consciously aware of it? And authority. Do they have the authority to make the decision? Focus changes state. What would be the best benefit of you doing this? When your question prompts someone to imagine, it becomes more real for them. If you told them instead of asked them, they wouldn't believe you. Remember, facts and information are outside of the outer circle of the brain, not the decision-making areas. So to enroll, two things: ask questions. This creates a focus, a canvas to paint a picture collaboratively. Ask questions so they'll get real experiences inside themselves and give real answers. Questions are the greatest assets. Questions empower you and the prospects by putting them in a state that makes things more congruent. And secondly, do something very real. Engage as many senses as possible to give a full experience. Some of the highest paid people in this country are people who induce state changes. What sells is what puts someone in a better state. People are buying your state of mind. They hope that your expertise will come with it. So, here's an exercise. Each night for 7 nights, before you go to bed, come up with 3 ideas about how you can get potential prospects to feel like they already own or participate in your product or service, even before buying it. Think of 3 creative and unique ways to do that consistently, or maybe, depending on your biorhythms, first thing in the morning, but do it systematically. Have a plan and stick to it. Now, if you do that each night for 7 nights, most of the 21 things you come up with may seem kind of goofy as you look at them in the cool light of the next morning, but you only need 1 or 2 to change your business. An example: a realtor whose clients like a particular house that they viewed, but they haven't decided yet. He then orchestrates an entire meal catered to this family in the home they're considering. They have a fabulous meal. They see the fresh flowers he's brought in. They can picture themselves in that home. That house, an experience of all the senses, became their story. His close rate, while others are in the single digits, his close rate is 80%. Model success. Find successful people and see what they do. They will most likely make the experience real using all 5 senses. If someone's eating food, they change their state, and the state links to the immediate anchor. That's why so much business is done at lunches and dinners. I remember back in the day when people actually did that. The realtor changed the state of mind of the purchasers and linked pleasure and family togetherness with that house. That's an anchor, an emotional anchor. He created a vivid Rorschach for the family to project their hopes and excitement. Whatever is happening around someone when they have a strong feeling, it will be linked, anchored. Now, it's not logical. Is there any relationship between dog chow and a bell? Well, if they're coupled, Pavlov showed us a dog thought so. Pavlov's dog linked the bell with food and salivated. Then only the bell was enough to cue anticipation. Put people in an environment that creates the state you want to link to your product. An example is the brilliant series of Super Bowl Budweiser commercials of the dog and Clydesdale, who are buddies. They induce a state of mind of connection and bonding and the release of oxytocin in the brain. Here's the best signal of a successful oxytocin release. Aww. The message goes right to your hippocampus to connect that experience with a Budweiser. Another example, the new car smell that puts you in a state to buy a new car. BMW makes their brochures with a new car smell. I can tell you that that's accurate. The total sensory and emotional experience with the salesperson, that's you, matters. Create. Brainstorm. There's always a way to make it real and effective. Ask questions. Create an experience. Point, tell, show. You want a blank that will blank. Is that correct? You want an investment that will bring you security and income. Is that correct? Ask a question that will put people's minds on the challenge, on the opportunity. Focus on the experience they're buying. Show to emphasize if all of this came true. If you had a seminar for your people, what would be the most important thing they get out of it? If you had three results, what would those be? If you don't get those, what would it cost you? An example from one of my training programs offering. If your organization had an internal mentoring program, how would your people benefit? Especially if the mentors were trained in the mind and brain sciences of change, including conversational, social, and emotional intelligence. Those two sentences could help someone who's in a decision-making capacity envision where they and their people could get to by doing the internal mentoring program with me. Ask questions. Don't tell them. Ask how much more effectiveness or more success would you have if you did this. Don't tell them. Get them to tell you. Another exercise. Write five questions to make it feel to the client that he or she already owns your product or service. An example is the real estate agent showing the house. The agent doesn't ask you what you think about the living room, but instead ask you, where would you put your entertainment center? The agent wants to have the prospects come up with their answer to experience it and envision it as if they already bought it. Three, compel, create conviction. People don't buy facts or features. They buy benefits from themselves. Remember, the first level of response is an emotional decision. Selling is the transfer of emotion. For someone to buy, they must feel certain they will get what they want. Conviction starts with you first, then to your client. But they have to buy or attend for their reasons, not yours. The number one way, give them the experience and conviction that they will get what they want and need out of your product or service. The number two way, match their number one to value. And for example, if it's freedom, show how it will enhance their freedom. Find the dominant emotion for buying, even though the prospect will want to believe it's for logical reasons. Copywriters tell us there are five great motivators for marketing. One is fear. Car and life insurance people use this. Exclusivity, to be special, chosen. When narcissism goes shopping, a sense of specialness appeals, even creates a special bond, an exclusive offer, a private invitation. Three is greed. Although it has a negative connotation, the true meaning of greed is a rapacious desire for more, to succeed massively. Four, guilt. Sometimes nonprofits use this. And finally, a need for approval. And think about the product advertisements for cars, for watches, for shirts with little animals on them. Give prospects several units of conviction to justify buying. A unit of conviction has these components. These are in your outline. I'll just hit on a couple of them. An assertion, you will, a fact, because, a benefit, what this could mean to you, and simply a permission to ask questions. My purpose at this time is to get your answers to these questions. The task of sales involves the science of neuromarketing. The questions you ask people determine what they focus on and the answers they come up with. Remember, we talked earlier about it's not what you say to someone, it's what they say to themselves based on the stimulus of what you said to them that they're going to remember. And that also is what causes them to act. Now, at any time we're only focusing on a small band of data, what's available to us? Our focus. Our brains are like a camera that we only see what we focus on. So do one feature at a time. The whole load. Forget about the wide-angle lens. Our imagination is 10 times more powerful than our will. Now, to review briefly and insert it here from second seminar, fear is the number one reason that stops action. So learn how to utilize imagination. Guide visualization to make it real for people. Paint it vividly. Ask questions. When you ask a question, it changes what someone focuses on. Whenever someone is focused on negative reasons, the fear, ask a question to refocus on the gain. Emphasize choosing the short pain instead. Experience the discomfort and use your energy to move ahead. Delaying the pain delays progress. So make it real and assume the sale. When people don't buy, it's usually because they've linked buying with more pain than not buying. When people do buy, they link more pleasure to buying than not buying. And remember, always, people buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. You can't omit either one of those in your consideration. So let's talk about some practical ways. How do you convert objections into commitments? If someone has an objection, rather than to counter, ignore, or circumvent it, don't, because that only engages it. Whatever we focus on, even denial, it engages it. Find out specifically what the objection is. An objection equates to getting more information for you. The best salespeople average 5 objections before a conversion. Be sure that an objection is not the projective voice of the seller. So an objection is a question in disguise. An objection provides an opportunity to hear the primary concern so it can be addressed and reframed, to understand better the person's fear or belief, and to listen for the real question. Objections are signposts. They're your resources. A mistake is to fight or counter the objection. The key to influence is to align with the person, to get inside the circle with them. In spite of the fear, will the benefit be greater in doing it? If the answer is yes in their gut, they're going to proceed. The best way to respond to an objection is to take each objection and interpret it as a question. So rather than a reason for not buying, hear it as a request for more information. For example, I can't afford it. Reframed. Please show me how I can afford it so it's worth it. Well, I have to talk it over with someone else. Reframed. Please give me enough reasons I can go ahead and decide now to buy it without having to check and get someone else's opinion. Welcome an objection because it's information and a stepping stone to success. It puts you on the same side as that client, rather than taking it personally and feeling that you have to defend or counter or justify. Use it to get inside the circle. Treat an objection as powerful and important. maybe even compliment the objection as a good question because it allows both of you to think about it and consider it. So here are some considerations, eight and counting, to convert objections into commitments. One, don't engage the objection by countering it. Focus directs attention. Two, hear them out. Three, perhaps feed it back as a question. It puts the objection back to the questioner to examine and then explain. Often when someone tries to explain an objection, they may withdraw it. Four, get more information. Is this the real objection? Five, align with the prospect to collaborate. In a collaboration, you're on the same side. Both of you are in the circle. If you find an objection, it will limit you. You immediately are positioned outside the circle. So instead of countering the question or the objection, align with it. I appreciate or I respect how you feel about that. Or it is an expensive investment to engage in mentor coaching. And then to have a conversation about that. Six, turn the objection into a question. Reframe it. Questions are the genesis of focus. You can't answer an objection, but you can answer and engage a question. It seems the real question is, can you get enough value to justify buying? It sounds like your concern is how you can get benefits now. Focus on the benefit rather than the concern. For example, if there's an issue with expense, reframe it. Brag about it. Do it up front. Even say if you believe, and I certainly do, I think this will have an exponential return on investment and make a major difference for your life or your business or your performance, whatever it is, for the rest of your life. But you have to believe that. You have to say it with confidence. You have to know it. And you'll both live into it. Assume the sale. The best persuaders assume the sale. Congratulate them on a wise decision. Don't thank them for the sale. The congratulations focuses on a wise decision. So here are a few words in closing about the psychology of closing. This is the point that both the salesperson and the prospect, and I know you hate to hear yourselves called salespersons, I do, may hate the most. Do the close as quickly and painlessly as possible. A man had a painful tooth that he knew needed to be extracted. He called his dentist. He'd been his patient for a long time. The two knew each other quite well. He asked how much the dentist would charge him to extract a tooth and how long it would take. The dentist replied, "I'll charge you $185 and it'll only take a minute." The man responded, "Only a minute? That's a lot of money for just a minute." The dentist said, "Well, if time is an issue, I can take as long as you want." Have your closings planned in advance, word for word, but sound natural and spontaneous, like you're talking, not reading a script. Remember, we talked about the close, the primary aspect of close. If you do a sample session or have a brief discussion about someone, is when you make your recommendation for professional coaching to be clear, brief, and succinct, to follow the three story components of the challenge, the development, and the resolution. Engage a positive, enthusiastic mindset. Clarify the client's requirements. Help the client understand what you're offering. Focus on the benefit. The four aspects. Prospects must want it, need it, afford it, and use it. Now, some closing strategies. Never tell a prospect that he or she is wrong. People convinced against their will are of the same opinion still. And most other people will still be of the same opinion. Go with the objection, indicating a valid concern with it. Then engage the message. Now, at times, you may want to consider third-party proof, a testimonial. Don't knock the competition. Sell and focus on the value and benefits of your product. Don't engage in personal issues with the client. Don't take personally anything the client says. This is part of beginning work as a professional coach, to put your ego in a blind trust. Don't assume authority you don't have, promises you can't keep that could be called overselling. and avoid negative expectations, especially deciding that the person's not going to buy. Now, remember, the hero is the person, place, product, or brand that enables someone to feel the change your story promises. How can you make your client the hero of his or her own story? Make it easy and create a future. A relationship that lasts through the years. The most important part, in my view, of the engagement is to give more than expected and to generate an ongoing relationship to prevent buyer's remorse. Do future pacing. Future pace occurs every time someone purchases, if you do it right. Have buyers imagine themselves in the future, the way they will use the product or service in the future. A year from now, what will you be doing with this training that will make you glad you've done it? Link something present to your product. For example, I build this into my training of mentor coaches, a quarterly mentor group, and white paper or some other continuing education. We just did one at noon today. Some of you guys have been on that. A free attendance at my teleseminars, a registry for referrals, for corporate mentoring programs after the training, a monthly mentor group teleconference for 12 months, each around a specific continuing learning topic. So it doesn't end. Give them a reason to buy. Theirs, not yours, emotional and logical. People will put off buying if they can, so think about units of conviction. Make it fun. Laugh. Change states. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have I said that before? So here's a summary of some strategies of successful people and top sellers. Affect your own emotional state. Reset after the last experience. A number one quality, prepare yourself physically and emotionally. Qualify prospects. Find their deepest needs, the core emotional need that drives that person, the challenge or pain point. Then teach them how to get through what you offer. Manage as much as possible the prospect's state of mind. That comes first from managing yours. Give prospects a way to justify buying to satisfy and meet a need. Remain flexible. The person most flexible controls the situation. To be successful, know the outcome, take action, know what getting closer and getting further away looks like. Change your approach until what you get will benefit the prospect, and become a team player, consistently attuned to the prospect's needs. Is there more value than the concern? Create and sustain interest, build trust, and rapport continuously. And finally, imagine inventing a device that can record memories, dreams, ideas, and transmit them to your brain that can change states of mind and sell anything you have to offer. This device, this game-changing technology, is called storytelling. We're in discussion mode now. If you'll be sure and manage your background noise, please go on mute until you're ready to talk, because your microphone will pick up any movement or ambient noise. So I welcome input, questions, thoughts, any reactions to what we've talked about, or things you'd like to talk about further.
Hi, David. It's Miriam.
Okay, I heard Miriam first, and I didn't hear who was next. Go ahead, please, and then we'll come back.
My question to you is, like, would coaching always be about challenging and limiting beliefs from the client?
I'm sorry. Would you start over, please, and ask that again?
Yeah, would coaching be always about challenging the limiting beliefs from the client?
No, it is not only about that. In fact, it may only be a small portion of what you do. Let me see if this answers your question. What we do in coaching is to listen for both the content and the process. The content is sometimes the easiest. Somebody needs help with time management. They need to develop a system for doing certain things, for writing. We help them create a system, allocate focus and structure. That's easy. That's the conscious, logical part. The challenge where we really earn our money is when that 90 to 95% of their operating system that's unconscious begins to manifest in the relationship itself, so that we have to create a working alliance to engage someone so that we can be able to have the necessary conversations with them to get them to self-reflect, to explore, to look at things that are not conscious or logical or intellectual, but that may be limiting, such as assumptions, as beliefs, as blind spots, various things that we want to look at with someone to help them recognize that. And, you know, a couple of questions for that may be, is this belief serving you or limiting you? Is there a way that you can look at this in a different way? What might it be costing you to look at it in this way? And simply, what are other possibilities? So that's only a portion, but the process inherent in all of those questions is opening rather than closure. And we convert in that process a period into a comma to look at, and is there more? What else to consider? Let's look at that in a different way. It's collaborative. It's not about information, instruction, training, teaching, because that will have the same result that everybody, including the bartender, has had, because the bartender will probably have as good a suggestions as we do. But what we can do is develop a collaborative alliance where the client can develop his or her story, and that's the point of reference in further development. Because if they needed, you heard me say before, if they needed information or facts, all they need to do is sign up for Google. Now, does that answer your question?
Yes. So sometimes it is conscious, but they just don't know what the next step would be. And then sometimes you would be unconscious. That's where the limiting beliefs would come from. But not always, yes, that answers my question.
Okay, that's what we do in a gap analysis, and that's where marketing comes in. The gap is between where somebody is and where they want to be. So that's where, that space is where our expertise is developed and applied. That's what we want to speak to as we engage someone to look at what they might like to do in coaching and to see where they want to get to, and then look at a way to collaboratively engage that. And remember, I mentioned earlier, one way of making a professional recommendation at the end of a discussion. You know, let's say, let me just review that to put those components of story into play here and to make it clear, brief, and simple, and very specific to engage the challenge, the development, the resolution. And again, think about any professional who you have a discussion with, a doc, a dentist, an attorney, a financial professional, anyone you have a discussion with, there's some questions, a discussion, and then the recommendation comes. That's where I want to create an analogy to what you hear with the best of professionals. Here's how that might sound after a sample session, where you've clearly identified a specific area for a client and had a sample session around that with reaching a destination for that specific topic. So here's a recommendation sample. Based on what we just talked about, this is a sample of a larger issue that I think could be of particular benefit for us to engage in mentor coaching. Here's what I would recommend: that we establish a standing time each week where you would call me for 50 minutes prior to the first appointment. I'd like you to do two things. One is I'm going to send you a client information packet for you to fill out. I think it'll be beneficial for both of us to get an overview. Send it back to me, and I'll send you a link for my monthly retainer as an online payment that will cover all of the sessions, whatever material and resources I send, plus contact by email in between. My monthly retainer is whatever your monthly retainer is. Any questions? Clear, brief, succinct, specific, and tied in to extend the discussion on a specific aspect. A sample, kind of like, you know, when you go to Baskin Robbins, remember back in the time, you get a little scoop. You don't get a big, you get a little spoon. You don't get a big scoop. You've sampled this. You've had an experience, created an experience of effectiveness with the client because you have clearly specified with the client exactly what they want to focus on and where they want to get to with it. That's a sample of what coaching will be. It provides a focus. The beauty of a focus, like with a map, is all the stuff you don't pay attention to. By focusing on one thing, it magnifies the effectiveness of doing that and creating a system. And remember, we've talked also, if you want to change, don't focus on the goal only. Everybody has the same goal. Focus on the system. Every coaching system, every coaching session is its own system. So I hope that was helpful. It was more than you asked, but there was a second comment or question. Please go.
Hi, yes, this is Jaden.
Hey, welcome.
I was wondering if you had any advice on cultivating the skill of conciseness, especially with so much passion behind our products.
Cultivating what?
Being concise.
Yes. I have some specific ideas and recommendations about that. What we know from neuroscience, and we've talked about this in an earlier seminar, is we attend to and retain up to 10 words at a time. After that, we begin to tail off with attention and retention. So keep your messages clear, brief, and succinct. Those are the four principles of good writing, same as good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. What I have, and some of you recognize this, what I have coaches do when they're doing a coach the coach, and there's a recording of each one, is to go through it and hit pause before they ask their question or make their comment, to write down in 10 words or less what question they would like to ask as a synopsis of something that inevitably is a good deal longer and may involve stacking questions, giving multiple choice, camouflaging a suggestion in the form of a question, or just talking in a paragraph. This is something we have to do in mentor coaching, because for us to have a coaching conversation, this defies what our brains have been hardwired for all our lives. We're hardwired to have conversations in paragraphs. And think about talking with buddies. You have a glass of Chardonnay on the patio. You say a few paragraphs. Your buddy says a few paragraphs. You're talking. You don't ask a simple question of 10 words or less. That's the power of the coaching engagement, because it helps the client focus. You've created a map by asking the client where they want to get to, or I'm sorry, you're asking the client what they specifically want to focus on, and then there's a second question, where they want to get to. To have the best and most effective sample session, do this when you establish a time when someone will call you for a brief conversation of a specified time, like 20 minutes, indicate that I think it will best give us both an idea of what it would be like to work together in professional coaching if you had a specific issue you want us to focus on and a specific destination you'd like us to get to in that 20 minutes. So you framed it as this is a pre-qualifying conversation. If it were just something you were doing for fun, you'd probably rather go running instead. But this is framed already as an engagement for potential professional consultation and collaboration. So clarity, brevity, simplicity. Because after, and I've emphasized to coaches who train with me, some of you guys have heard this, if you want to ask a lengthy question, say the most important things in the first 10 or 12 words, because after that, your client's going to probably be planning what they have for dinner. Think about your experiences in hearing somebody who doesn't keep the burden of clarity himself or herself, or who goes on and on. It creates a cognitive expense. A cognitive ease is 10 to 12 words or less, and you can attend to and retain that and engage fully. After that, there's a kind of a slippage. It's inefficient. So work at that. Think about how you want to say what you want to say. Remember that your hub statement, how much work it took to get that down to 10 to 12 words and to say your specific niche and the specific benefit in 10 to 12 words. Work on it in the same way that you did your hub statement. Have the follow-up as carefully crafted, because a successful response to a hub statement is, tell me more. That doesn't mean you start talking in paragraphs if you want to get clients. Have that next sentence or two as carefully crafted as you did the first to illustrate or amplify, give an example, in order to make it about that person as a particular client. You want to create the conversation with the client as point of reference. A simple example, someone asks you, what do you do? Instead of going into a spiel about professional coaching and the benefits and what it does, a simple response may be, what is the greatest challenge of your life or your business right now? And they tell you, that's exactly what I do. I'm a professional coach. I help practicing professionals create strategies to achieve and sustain peak performance. Or whatever your statement is for that person, but it has to sound like you talking, not like you reading something, not like you saying something just routinely, but you talking. So it's going to sound different if you're talking to the guy who's the manager of the car wash as it would a farmer or rancher in West Texas, as it would the professional development group or the CEO NetWeavers. Those are three applications for me in beginning mentor coaching, and I realized quickly all three of those are going to sound real different. To the farmer or ranchers, I help you do your business better. That said the same thing in all those words I used about practicing, you know, it said it to that I was talking to that person. Remember, you're talking to a person. You're not trying to convey something you've memorized. If you have memorized it, throw it away. It'll sound natural and start talking to that person. Helpful?
Yes, very. Thank you.
Okay, great. Other thoughts or comments, or even different ideas? What else would be helpful for us to talk about?
David, Miriam again.
So hey, welcome. Go ahead.
I'm like a super analytical and rational mind. We still like purchase emotionally instead. I mean the package per se. Would you have the same approach?
Okay, you be that person. Tell me, just frame it in no more than two sentences. You be that person, and I'm going to be the best version of you to respond so that it comes alive, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Tell me in a sentence who that person is and what that person would do or ask analytically, whatever. You be that person, and I'll try to be a good you, okay?
Okay, yes.
What's the framework? Who are we talking about?
We're talking about, I'm a perfectionist procrastinator, and I'm not sure if this is going to work for me in the long run.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of questions just to get an idea of how we might work together. First thing is to look, when you procrastinate, to look at if you have a plan and then decide, no, I'm not going to stick to it. How do you go about deciding that? What's your internal conversation when you say no? So first, do you have a plan? Do you have a specific plan about when to begin that you then say no to at the very time you would start?
Yes.
Okay. Let's say the last time you did that, you had a plan, you decided to begin at a specific time, and then you decided, no, I'm not going to do it. What was your internal conversation? In other words, was it, to hell with it, I'm going to go have a good time? Did you defy your own authority? Did you bargain with yourself? Well, I'm going to start next Tuesday instead of now. Or did you kind of lose track or not know what the first step was? Let's look at that specifically.
It would be, this is silly, it's not good enough, so I'm not going to keep going on it.
Okay, so the first step is you stopped yourself. Now, anytime we stop ourselves, there's always going to be any number of reasons that make it make sense to stop. We create contingencies to, and I'm going into a commentary now away from the he said, she said. We create contingencies to rationalize or postpone the initiation of an action or a new or challenging or tedious. This makes it understandable and sufficient reason not to proceed, but it only serves as a stopping point. Well, I really need to organize my office before I get started on the book. Well, I need to take care of some correspondence before I start. Or I don't think I have a good enough plan. Or I'll wait until I have time without interruption before starting my tax preparation. So that's the area that I would begin. And if this is a coaching conversation, I would proceed in one way. But if it's a sample session, I might begin in a way to look at one specific recent instance, to look at what was that conversation you had with yourself, as you just said, and then look at how you stopped yourself, and then fill that in with a reason to make it make sense. But that really probably wasn't the reason you stopped. Anytime we stop ourselves, we're avoiding some kind of pain. That's been wired in our brains from an evolutionary standpoint. We had assumed some pain. Well, you know, if I proceed, I'm going to be shown as inadequate, or I'll give it my best and I'll still fail. Whatever. It's not that you're sabotaging yourself, but you stop yourself to avoid some kind of pain and then make it make sense to stop so you don't have to keep thinking about it, because that's kind of painful too. So a coaching question at that juncture, once you've developed that, and I'm compressing a lot into a brief time here because I don't want to go too much over, we're already over what we talked about. What's the greater pain if you don't proceed? And what's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? Those are the two most basic motivations that we have as human beings that are evolutionarily wired to avoid pain and to seek pleasure. If someone doesn't do something, you can't automatically assume they're trying to sabotage themselves. They may be avoiding pain. That's what we look at. That's a here and now. That's not therapy. That's not counseling. This is the choice architecture of this present moment. You decide, after you have a plan, which is always the first question in coaching, to decide not to proceed. That's the coaching juncture right there. To look at that and to look at that, to look at the possibilities, to look at not just what's lost and what you assume you're avoiding, but what's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? How can you convert that to a challenge, a possibility that creates new neuronal networks and pathways? Because what we know, and I'm going to have to stop here, what we know is that how we frame something determines how we proceed. And our brain doesn't know the difference between anxiety and excitement. If you frame that instant as anxiety, that I'm not going to be good enough, I'm not going to know how to do it, it makes sense to stop and you head for cover. If you frame it, the experience, as excitement, then you look for the challenge, the possibility to shrink the change to the next step to get one step of effectiveness and mastery, because that's what you can build on, and then ask, what's the next step? Great question. I hope that was a beginning of an answer. Thank you all very much for all of your input, interaction. I appreciate all the questions you sent in at the beginning and throughout and the discussion. Through and including our last minutes, I'm sorry we can't just take a lot more time. If I can help you guys in any way, please let me know. I'll be eager to hear what your thoughts and reflections are as you begin to apply some of what we've been talking about. You don't get off the hook here. You got to take this and run with it. So I hope it's effective and helpful. Let me know how it goes. Thanks very, very much. I hope we cross paths again. And again, if I can be helpful to you, let me know. Thanks so much. See you guys. Bye.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, Dave. Bye, everybody.
Yeah.